So the overview of today's class. I'm going to try to convince you that the future is now, that all this talk about the genetic revolution is not pie in the sky stuff for venture capitalists for the next 10 years, but it's stuff that is of immediate practicality today. I'll spend a little bit of time of distinguishing between genomic and genetic, more for your taxonomical edification than for any substantive reason. We have to touch upon heredity and what that is all about. Well, and then we have to talk about the fundamentals of the resequencing of the diagnostic process that's be put into effect by the availability today of all this genomic data. And then I'm going to finish up about how all this is resulting in accelerating consumer activation. And for those of you who are practitioners of medicine, and there's a subset of you who are, this should be alarming, not that it's bad that consumers get involved, but that they're ahead of us in their knowledge and application of this knowledge. So the future is now. So just because some of us don't, in fact, claim not to have taken any biology, I just want to review some basics. This will be old hat to some of you, but since you may not have that old hat, I'm going to review it. This is the old dogma, and this dogma is flawed, and it's not quite true. Hey, welcome. Just introduce yourself.
Todd Thompson.
And you're a student at?
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm a student at MIT.
Interesting student, chemistry background. All right. Todd, have you ever had a basic genetics course in your life? I asked this over questions. Yes?
Yeah.
All right. Undergrad. All right. So, I'm just reviewing the basic dogma, which is DNA gives rise to transcribed RNA, which gives rise to translated protein. So let me ask a question of the class. And I'm going to start saying you because I can't remember your names yet. Is the DNA in each cell in our body the same?
No.
Why is it different?
As the cells differentiate maybe over time?
Good, because you just stated the misunderstanding that most people have. In fact, with exception of your sperm or eggs, all the genome in the entire body is exactly the same. It's the full genome is available. In fact, the reason you can clone an animal from any somatic cell in the body, in theory, is because, with some caveats, which I don't want to get into right now, it's in fact the same darn genome. The exceptions are gametes, which have half of the genome, and red blood cells, which have no nucleus. Now, why is that important? And there's some other things like methylation and the tips of chromosomes, which I don't want to give you details. But why is that important? Because, in fact, what makes a liver cell different from a white blood cell is not the DNA, but what RNA is being transcribed, and also what protein is being translated from the RNA. And the reason I bring this up is because as we measure DNA using sequencing or genotyping, or we're measuring RNA using transcriptional profiling, or we measure translation using proteomics, we have to start thinking now, even those of us who are not MDs, as clinicians, where can we actually obtain this biological material? And if you're doing a DNA study, anything is good. You can get white blood cells, you can get a blood sample. But if you wanted to study, for instance, brains and understand what makes someone susceptible to brain tumors, you could not get a RNA sample without actually getting a hunk of someone's brain. And so that immediately tells you some limitations of these technologies. So if you want to do RNA or protein profiling based on this, to look at someone's likelihood to get a disease, for instance, you have to get the right tissue. And that tells you the kind of limitations that we face when we're doing clinical studies. I mean, certainly we can hack out brains out of mice or Drosophila, but we can't readily do that with humans. And yet, that's frustrating because on this end, we're closer to function than we are to this end. This is the master code, but this is what leads to the actual functioning, the interacting of the proteins. And so people are very excited about proteomics, for instance, because it's very close to function. But when you're looking about what are we going to actually be measuring the proteins on, we're fairly limited to things like serum and urine. We can't take pieces of tissue out of human beings. And we can talk on another day about how to get around these obstacles. So what's the magnitude of the task? From one perspective, it seems relatively piddling. I mean, there's, after all, 46 chromosomes, and these chromosomes are these little microscopic things, and with bushy things of hypercoiled DNA, and it seems fairly discrete. And I know you know it's 3 billion bases, but I want to give you an appreciation for how much 3 billion bases are. So let's say we have a necklace of beads. Each of those beads represents one base pair. Can I take it for granted that you all know what the base pairs are? ACTG. Right, good. So if you took a bunch of these necklaces and gave them to everyone, a necklace to everyone in Shea Stadium, it would still take 1,000 stadia to get enough necklaces to get all the bases that we have in the human genome. So that's a lot of beads. And it's a lot, I mean, it gives you some sense of the coding challenge and the deciphering challenge. But you'll have technology nerds say the following. Some say that Madonna's music is actually more information than Madonna the person. Because I actually heard this from someone in Microsoft say this in a big plenary talk. Because they said, look, a DVD with her music video is 4.7 gigabytes. Whereas her genome, 3 billion base pairs at 2 bits per base, since there's 4 bases, and 8 bits per byte, is only 3/4 of a gigabyte. So what are we making the big deal about? And in fact, they went on to say correctly that every human is, on average, only less than 0.1% different than any other human. So we can actually store you all as just the difference file of you, of everybody else. So you can, it turns out, if you did that, you can compress you down to the size that could fit nicely on an obsolete diskette. But that's the question that I want to then raise. Is Madonna her DNA sequence? And the answer, I hope you realize, is no. Because what makes Madonna, particularly Madonna, is not only the way she developed in her womb, even without environmental influences as programmed, but all the developmental influences she had through her life, the good knocks, the bad knocks, all those experiences, environmental exposures that bring her state, her organismal state, into the current megastar state it is. And there are many other states it could have been, depending on what those environmental influences were. And if you really want to capture a state, it's not only, it's therefore the evolution of her physical state, not just her genome, but all the alternative splicing. As you'll hear about next lecture, genes can be spliced in multiple ways to create RNA. So that's on average about 3 per gene. The proteins, which are derived from RNA, can have a multitude of different modifications, adding of glucose, glycosylation, adding of phosphorus, phosphorylation. And in fact, this is underestimated. I'm giving you that's on the order of 100 to 1,000 modifications. So that greatly increases the complexity. And then, in a multicellular organism, each of those gene products can be in any particular compartment in the cell, and then can float around to any cell in the body on the order of trillions. So Madonna now is several orders of magnitude larger than her music, as we are all. And this is just as a caveat to note that although it's really impressive that we can sequence an entire genome, all we're showing is one, the master code that can result in one of many potential fates. And to avoid the reductionism that often happens, you have to remind yourself what were the environmental influences. And we'll come back to that again. Now, getting on again a more optimistic technological note, it is nonetheless true that we can now measure today with commodity technology large parts of your genome for commodity prices. And what do I mean by that? Let's look at RNA microarrays. And I know some of you know about these and some of you don't, but I just want to remind you of them. If you take a tissue, let's say liver, or tissue, by the way, let me just interrupt myself to say that all these PowerPoint presentations, thank you, all these PowerPoint presentations and the video are going to be available through the My Courses website. If you don't have an account yet through My Courses, you can definitely get one. And so all the PowerPoint and all the video will be available. So don't feel compelled to take everything down and just be more sure that you're asking questions in the flesh. So take liver, or let's say liver under influence of perhaps insulin. You take it, you grind it up, you label the RNA that was extracted from that ground up liver with a fluorescent compound. That means you attach a fluorescent compound to that labeled RNA. And then you purchase, and I used to say purchase or make, but that's becoming less and less true. It truly is becoming a commodity, and companies such as Affymetrix or Agilent will sell you these chips, and they can do it probably with higher quality, unfortunately, than we can in the homebrew fashion. Even though, if you go to the Stanford website, microarray website, they'll tell you how to build your own microarray manufacturing facility out of RadioShack parts for less than $10,000. Nonetheless, it's easier and more standardized at this time to unfortunately buy it from this Microsoft-like monopoly called Affymetrix, for instance. In any case, so you buy this chip, and pre-positioned on each spot on this chip, and I will have a whole lecture devoted to microarray, so don't worry about the details too much. Pre-positioned on each spot on this microarray is a sequence of DNA corresponding to the gene that you're looking for. So this might be the sequence of DNA corresponding to growth hormone, a sequence of DNA corresponding to insulin, a sequence of DNA corresponding to the insulin receptor. And what's going to happen is through the hybridization reaction that you all learned in basic genetics, the RNA that you extract from the tissue will hybridize with the matching sequence of DNA that is present on this chip. And suddenly these chips are no bigger than this, if not smaller. And then you're scanning using a simple HP scanner of no higher quality than the one that you use to scan in your family photos. You scan the image of the chip, and it fluoresces proportional to the amount of fluorescent RNA at any given spot. And so what you have is a readout now at every spot of how much of that RNA was present in that sample. And the current density of Affymetrix microarrays is now that on a single chip, they have spotted, and this is using actually a photolithographic process, they have spotted every single gene in the human genome. In fact, so many so that they're actually putting extra ones, such as different alternative splices. So more than 30,000 genes on one chip, and you can buy it through Harvard pricing for about $250. So you can measure the expression of 30,000 genes for $250. Now, that sounds academically as an interesting thing, but how does that translate into genomic medicine? So let me give you my poster child for a classical study which has launched 1,000 chips, but chips as well. It's launched several million chips. This was a study that was done out of Stanford, and they did the following thing. They had patients with large B-cell lymphoma. Large B-cell lymphoma is a type of cancer that is on the sort of medium bad disease, not as bad as lung disease, not as benign as thyroid disease. Thyroid cancer. And this is a disease that was previously monolithic. In other words, the patient came to you and you looked on the microscope, you said, you have large B-cell lymphoma, and you had a rough estimate on how long they're going to live, and you give them all the same treatment, because you could not distinguish between subclasses of these patients. So what they did, through techniques that you'll learn about in this class, is they performed a clustering analysis on these patients when they took RNA extracted out of the lymphoma of several dozen patients. And when they did a clustering experiment, they were able to see that there are two groups of patients based solely on their gene expression profile. That there was one group of patients that had one gene expression profile and another group of patients that had different gene expression profile. Then, and only then, they asked themselves after the fact, what was different about these patients? And very rewardingly, they found that corresponding to one gene expression profile, in other words, one set of genes being switched on or off, was this group of patients in red, where here on the x-axis is years of survival, here on the y-axis is probability of survival. And so what you see here is one group of patients who die very fast, most of them, by 2 years, and one group of patients who have better than 50% survival in the 12-year outcome. And that was remarkable, because it told us that previously, where we had not had a diagnosis, a subdiagnosis, we have now a new diagnosis, high risk and low risk large B-cell lymphoma. Two, we have a new prognosis. We can tell patients, unfortunately, this profile, you're at much higher risk than you would have told them previously. Three, you have a new clinical opportunity, a new therapeutic opportunity, because without discovering any new drugs, you're just going to hit these ones much harder with the chemotherapeutic agents that you already have, because you know that they are much, they essentially have a much more dangerous kind of cancer. And then fourth, you have a new research opportunity. Why are these patients dying off? Are they pumping out? Do they have a transporter that's pumping out chemotherapeutic agents out of the cell? It's unclear, but we already know that they're using this as research to, for instance, turns out this is a B-cell marker. This group is enriched for B-cell markers. B-cells are a type of immune cell, and they're actually using a therapy directed against that B-cell to actually treat these patients. So that's fairly remarkable. From a trivial clinical research experiment using this commodity chip, we have a new diagnosis, a new prognosis, a new therapeutic opportunity, and a new research opportunity. And this has been reproduced multiple times for lung cancer, for breast cancer. You can now actually purchase a test in the Netherlands that, based on the needle biopsy of the breast, will actually stratify the woman on her prognosis based on the needle biopsy. And it's not only for cancers. Now it's being done for a variety of inflammatory conditions, inflammatory bowel disease, rheumatoid arthritis, all a bunch of conditions where you're actually getting a much broader insight into the physiology by looking at 30,000 genes than you were by just looking at a patient, asking a few questions, and measuring just one or two variables in their blood. So it brings us to this cartoon. It says, "You're not ill yet, Mr. Blendell, but you've got potential." And of course, this is the motivation behind a lot of genomic medicine, that we're going to be able to, by having these highly forecasting markers, these predictive markers, we're going to be able to move away from acute and expensive and not very effective interventions to much more cost-effective, cheaper, more effective prevention techniques. And it's not theoretical. Right now, one of the largest groups, by the way, how does chemotherapy actually get devised? How do these protocols get devised? There's these large cooperative oncology groups, literally dozens of hospitals and medical centers that cooperate on devising how much of cisplatin, how much adriamycin, how much azathioprine to give to various patients with various chemotherapy protocols. And they treat these thousands of patients, see how they do, and then issue a new protocol based on outcome. Very highly funded, on the order of hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And today, because I'm part of now of the Cancer and Leukemia Group B, this one of these cooperative groups is now, this entire group is now coming up with new protocols. They're all based on genome-wide understanding of expression. In other words, they're going to put you into a different treatment category based on your gene expression and profile. And this should worry you, because as you learn in this class, there's a lot about this analysis, this clustering analysis. I gave you the shining great story about it, but even that initial analysis I showed you of large B-cell lymphoma is flawed. And yet, people are moving ahead very fast to turn these into clinically used diagnostics. And because they don't understand fundamentally the limitations of their clustering techniques, for instance, and the limitations of the measurement platforms like the microarray analysis, they're actually going to do patients disservices by taking patients who don't need the therapy and put them into a high-risk class and vice versa. So I think it's hugely important. One of the things that I want you to learn in this class is how to read skeptically the literature, because in fact it'll help you become better leaders in this area of high-dimensional medicine. What do I mean by high-dimensional? Well, you're looking at thousands and thousands of variables. Well, here we're just looking at expression, but as we'll get to later in the course, it's of course looking at all the different SNPs in on your genome, the different variations, I should say, and your protein state. So this is, you know, the current state of art for those of you not doctors is the stage of the cancer, where is it in your body, the grade, how ugly do the cells look under the microscope, and what kind of cell type are they, is typically what drives diagnosis today. But even today, it's now starting to be driven in real protocols, being deployed by real for real patients by expression profiling. And that begs the question that I think is now upon us, which is, are we now on the threshold of a new taxonomy of human diseases? Human disease has been classified according to manifestation, and it's actually not so long ago that we used to think of fever as a disease rather than a symptom. And if you look very closely at most diseases, like the inflammatory diseases like arthritis, they're still, for the most part, based on phenomenology and not on a deep mechanistic etiology or a cause. And Thomas Lewis pointed out in 1944, the diagnosis of most human disease provides only insecure and temporary conceptions, because in fact what we're describing is always the tip of the iceberg, the things that the patients complain about. And there's only so many things you can complain about. This hurts, you know, and I can or cannot do this. And there's a limited set of all the ways you can manifest, but it's actually reflecting a much larger multitude of possible things that can go wrong in this very complex a mechanism that is the human being. And in fact, of the main common diseases, only infectious diseases have a truly mechanism-based nomenclature. If you see how people name infectious diseases, it goes right down to the organism causing it. The rest of it is pretty loosey-goosey as it relates to the mechanism. And here we have part of the challenge in genomic medicine is, if we're measuring comprehensively the entirety of the physiology of the patient state, we can actually come with a much more objective and universal nomenclature, which is a non-trivial thing for medical students is there any medical students in here? Yes. Who are being assaulted by the, I was told once in medical school that I had to learn on the order of 20,000 new terms, and you can see that they're already outdated. There's also reason why today we should be thinking about changing the use of everyday medications. Shown here is the protein that codes for a potassium channel. It's a protein that allows potassium in or out in a selective fashion in and out of cells. And it turns out, if you have a misspelling or a polymorphism of one of your nucleotides here, then it will result in a new amino acid in one spot. And that will change the electrical properties of this potassium channel, such that individuals are much more prone to cardiac arrhythmias, bad rhythms of their heart, if they are given a sulfa drug. Now, sulfa drugs, for those of you who don't know, are a broad range of antibiotics. And in pediatrics, for instance, we give almost all kids sulfa drugs. Bactrim has part of it a sulfa drug. And so what we're saying here is there is a subset of children who have this mutation. And if you give them sulfa drugs today, you're going to put them at risk of death, which seems like a bad decision for just treatment of earache. Now, if you're still awake, you should be asking yourself the following. Well, Zach, you're telling me about this, but why should I really be worried about this? It's obviously a rare thing. It's probably less than 1 in 10,000. And why should I do this expensive re-engineering of the medical process in order to be able to avoid harming these children? So I'm going to ask you a question. How much do you think in a high-throughput laboratory like the Channing Laboratory across the street, how much do you think it costs to see if your genome has this polymorphism, and therefore we should be careful about treating with sulfa drugs? How much do you think it would cost us to process your blood and obtain the which spelling you had for that one polymorphism? And I've asked this of the entire class, and I've asked this endless times for very senior people and very junior people. Unless you don't know, unless you really know the answer, then don't answer. But let's go forward. The Price is Right rules work.
Well, you assume that you have the blood sample already there. It's just the cost to run the test.
Yes, I'm not asking you to pay for the blood draw. Right. How much?
$30.
Less than a buck.
$130.
$5? How much?
$1.
What? 50?
I think I
read
that somebody said. 100?
No, less than $1. So let's give you reality. Today you'd be charged, which is not the question I asked you, you'd be charged approximately $500 to $1,000. The actual cost, if you're running the test, in time of your technician and materials, so the full cost is, if you're extremely inefficient, 50 cents. If you're very efficient, 10 cents. So that's important to realize, because we are now, today, in an emergency room, routinely sending off the SMA20, which is 20 different things, like sodium, potassium, chloride, carbon dioxide, BUN, creatinine, and so, and a few other tests. And this is, and you charge on the order of, or your insurance, hopefully, is charged on the order of $100 to $200 to do that. The marginal cost of this is no higher than of doing those electrolytes. So what this tells us is that today is possible to run, for uncommon diseases, 1,000 different SNP tests at a cost-effective way, so that even though your polymorphism is rare, if it has clinical significance, we can find 1,000 different rare polymorphisms that in aggregate may end up to being a lot of people. And this is, I am not the only one to have recognized this, and there are now a bunch of companies which understand this. So the companies who previously were charging $1,000 per test are under some cost pressure. And to give you a sort of reality-based feeling for this, probably what you'll see over the next 5 to 10 years, as this technology, as the understanding of this technology is actually at commodity level, is that that price is going to be crushed down from the 1,000 level to 10. Of course, they're going to resist every step of the way and try to charge every last dollar along the way, but it's sort of an internet kind of effect, because the true costs are trivial, and we're charging the government these bulk rate prices all the time for our human association studies. So this is a hugely important understanding to have. And why is this so important to understand? Because if you look at the number of publications of different polymorphisms that occurred with time, this is 1980, this is 2005. And what you see here is that it's been growing steadily and not so slowly every year, so that we're now close to 8,000 publications per year about reporting on different polymorphisms. Now, as you'll hear in two or three lectures of them from now, well over 50% of these are wrong reports. And one of the things you have to learn in this class is what constitutes a good versus a bad report, a risk factor based on, or protective factor based on a polymorphism. Nonetheless, it's telling you that there's thousands of polymorphisms out there, even if 50% of them are wrong, of the reports are wrong, thousands of polymorphisms that are associated with clinical disease that are being reported on literature per year. So that's a huge number. And as we'll get to shortly, genomics is not about single gene diseases. And nonetheless, the number of diseases that are being found to have a monogenic basis is growing even faster, exponentially, from 1981 till the millennium. And so what I told you until now, that the 5 cent figure was, I wanted to make sure you understood that was true today. The following is not in the so distant future. It's actually doable now, but it's at a research basis only. This is a big chip. It's a chip made out of many Affymetrix chips, sold by a company called Perligen, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Affymetrix. I'll tell you more about this chip two or three lectures from now. But suffice it to say that instead of interrogating for a different gene in every spot, it's interrogating for every single possible misspelling of the entire human genome, entire human genome on this collection of chips. So that in one fell swoop, this is actually just for chromosome 21, you could actually fully genotype the entire chromosome of an individual within 2 hours. And that's available today. It's commodity technology. It's just too expensive to be able to give you the same sense of reality as I did for single SNP genotyping. And this just shows that they're able to comprehensively show the frequencies and distribution of different SNPs across these individuals in one fell swoop. And that reminds me, within the next day, I'm going to start uploading to the My Courses website. I'll get to you in a second. To the My Courses website, PDFs of all the class reading. So today, I'm going to backfill it with things that would be relevant to today's lecture. Nonetheless, for future lectures, you will have the PDFs for the lecture of that day prior to that day. So, you were going to ask a question.
Yeah, I'm a different side for one class to work at. These are just identified and sequenced genes, or is this coming out of the genome project, and it's based upon the, I guess,
So what it's based on is several it's a confluence of several industrial. Well, what is it? Each little sequence on this microarray corresponds. I'm on the blackboard. Each sequence corresponds to a stretch of DNA, which and the center of that little stretch of DNA, that oligonucleotide, 20 bases, in the middle of that is the polymorphism. And so, let's say that you want to capture all four possible polymorphisms. For that stretch of DNA, you'll have four nucleotides corresponding to the A or C or T or G that's different on that central base. So on here are all the different polymorphisms that are known for chromosome 21. So how do they get that? It's a combination of the verified SNPs from the Human Genome Project, the verified SNPs from Celera, which they had to pay cold cash for, but they're a company, they have no problem with that. And they also licensed SNPs from ABI, from Aplera Biosystems. And finally, they did some their own resequencing, so they would know what are all the SNPs, the common SNPs for this region. So you're able to, in one fell swoop, directly assess through hybridization of DNA now, not RNA, which are the genotypes of the ones I know. Now, if it was not known, then it wouldn't show up here.
So, just as a follow-up question, seeing as how these are SNPs that are known from and taken from the sources, and we know that those sources are basically a few sample subjects.
Yes.
Are we going to talk at all in the course of
the class
about the implications of the fact that we're taking from a very small pool of individuals and comparing other people's, right?
We are definitely, okay, so what you're referring to is, for instance, the both Human Genome Project and the Solar Project were based on well under 20 individuals each. And so I have two comments. One, a comment which I'm not too comfortable with, but nonetheless true, is that if it's a common SNP, it'll show up and typically in one of those 20, more or less. Actually, the danger is the opposite, is that a lot of private mutations, in other words, you may share a SNP with you and your immediate family, wherever you came from, that's not present in anybody. But if you're one of the 20, that now has this major representation in this database, and it's probably the other direction that we have to worry about. Nonetheless, the answer to it is very simply this, is massive resequencing of a lot more individuals. And as this technology becomes commoditized, that problem is going to go away. So the HapMap project, for instance, is a project which you'll hear about during this class, and it's a project to actually define the structure of SNPs across larger populations and across ethnically diverse populations, because as I hinted to you in that term private mutations, you can imagine, or you will be taught, that there are different subpopulations that have these SNPs that are only present in a subpopulation, either within subpopulation called your family or subpopulation called people that came from that continent that you originally came from. So the short answer is, it's a problem, but it's a problem more on one side than the other. In other words, let me rephrase that. There's a certain frequency of common SNPs, about one per kilobase. But if you look at rare SNPs, they have a much, much higher frequency. In other words, I have a bunch of SNPs that are just unique to me and a few thousand people that have a shared heritage with me. And those probably don't have, by the way, for the most part, any clinical significance, but if I were one of the 20, it would be overrepresented in that sample. It's not a common SNP. So this makes the following simple point. It's answering the following question: why is computation such a central part to genomic medicine? And simply this. These two 1999 style stock curves, stock market curves, correspond to the following two processes. This shallower curve is the number of publications in Medline, the online repository of articles, and it goes all the way back to a century, Index Medicus, and it's a exponential curve. But because of the industrialization of gene sequencing, the number of sequences have risen at a far higher exponential curve, and what you can think of this as a proxy for the knowledge gap. If you take this to be genomic data, the gene sequences being genomic data, and this being as a proxy for our knowledge, this gap is growing. And it's growing even faster than it's portrayed here, because it's not just DNA sequence. It's genetic maps, physical maps, polymorphism, structure information, gene transcription patterns, protein translation activity. And all of these end up in databases. And if you are, like me, in the middle of a medical center, you'll find that there's very, very few people who are trained as clinicians and who have the requisite computational skills. So I have a PhD in computer science, but that's not the typical medical path. A lot of you in this room actually have the nice joint skill set, but you're in the minority. And consequently, because all these data types end up in a database, trying to translate this into medicine is fundamentally devolved to the responsibility of individuals who can both understand the biological problems and translate through a variety of computational techniques all this data into more knowledge. So the hubris, the conceit of bioinformaticians is that somehow we can use computational techniques to raise this to that level. Well, we did the Madonna complex already. So now let's talk about what is genomic versus genetic, because you hear these terms a lot as if they're interchangeable, and they kind of will be, but they're not quite yet. And it depends on your perspective, so let me just tell this joke. I hope you think it's a joke. An engineer, a physicist, a mathematician, a computer scientist, and a statistician are on a train heading north and had just crossed the border into Scotland. They look out the window and they see a black sheep for the first time. The engineer exclaims, "Look, Scottish sheep are black." The physicist yells, "No, no, some Scottish sheep are black." The mathematician looks irritated and says, "There is at least one field containing at least one sheep of which at least one side is black." The computer scientist says, "Oh no, a special case." And in fact, it's how you view genomics and genetics actually corresponds to where you find yourself on the spectrum. So that'll probably inform you why there is some global confusion. And finally, the statistician, I forgot, says it is not statistically significant. So here's one view of genomic versus genetic. So genetic medicine, the kind of medicine that's been around for us for a long time, has to do with low frequencies of high penetrance genes, by which I mean genes that if you have that particular mutation in that gene, is going to give you a high likelihood of having that disease. And there's thousands of these relatively uncommon diseases. The most common of these, hematochromatosis, which is iron deposition in the liver, has a frequency in the population of about 1 in 300. And these diseases previously had been mostly assessed indirectly or focused on single genes, by which indirectly linkage, for instance, linkage within a family. In contrast, genomic medicine is about not that you're rare disease, but just common diseases. It's diabetes, cancer, heart disease, inflammatory diseases. And therefore, almost by definition, the genetic risk for common disease will be often due to disease-producing alleles with relatively high frequencies, that is, greater than 1%. And all disease genes, in this perspective, may be disease-causing. And they're not for uncommon diseases, they're for common disorders, and they're due to the interactions of multiple genes and environmental factors. And because of the industrialization, in genomic medicine, we do direct experimental access to the entire genome in the fashion that I just illustrated. Someone else, McCusick and Peltonen, have given a related similar distinction between genetic and genomic. In genetics, you're looking at basically the structure of genes, the sequence. In functional in genomic medicine, you're looking at the function of these genes. In genetic disease, you're looking at genomics, you're looking at DNA. In genomic medicine, we're looking at more than just the gene. We're looking at the RNA and the proteins. This is what I refer to already, map-based gene discovery, in other words, probabilistic linkage between loci versus direct sequence-based gene discovery. I mean, now diseases are being discovered computationally. I don't know if I'll get around to it, but there's a great example now of how people are discovering cholesterol risk factor genes purely based on our shared attributes in our genome between man and mouse. Without having ever poured a beaker, people are actually being able to computationally just identify new risk factors in that fashion. But perhaps I will get to that. It just occurred to me that I don't have a lecture anymore on comparative genomics, which is how do we actually take advantage of the genomes of other species to inform us about human medicine. Maybe I should retroactively fit that in. And again, in genetics, it's monogenic disorders. In genomics, it's multifactorial disorders. And there's a specific DNA diagnosis in genetic disease. You have this disease, as opposed to genomics, it's more you're at risk for the following factors because it's not, in fact, a high penetrance disease. And you're looking at gene action in genetic disease, and you're looking more at genetic regulation in genetic medicine. And etiology, a specific mutation versus, because a mutation just tells you there's an error which is associated with a disease, whereas in genomic medicine you're saying, how did this error come to give rise to this disease? And in genetics, it's one species, in genomics, it's several species. Now, I think you could, in good faith, actually argue that there's a lot of overlap in these two, but that's broadly how the world seems to be divided. And I believe that will be blurred soon. But I think an important take-home message is that in genomic medicine, we really look comprehensively at all data types. And basically, you view the patient, if you want to look at them in a reductionist fashion, as the following kind of matrix. We're looking at environmental data, single nucleotide polymorphisms, proteomic measurements, gene expression measurements, and clinical measurements such as your history, your physical exam, laboratory studies, and imaging studies, all across time. But although there is missing data, and although these are incomplete, you can now view the patient as this big time series that you can apply a lot of machine learning techniques to cluster patients together to create new diagnosis, and predictive modeling techniques to figure out where in the space of possibilities of these attributes is the patient likely to be in the future. And it's this comprehensiveness that I think characterized genomic medicine. As we will get to later in the course, I will identify how, unfortunately, this is becoming a commodity. Only genomic measurements are cheap, as I just illustrated to you, but this part, because you have to deal with these dumb doctors, it's very expensive, because it's labor-intensive. Trying to assess the phenotype of the patient is a labor-intensive process, just as medical care is, just as education is. And so why do we have to be comprehensive? What, other than just liking to be comprehensive, what is our motivation? And the answer is very simple. It comes from a understanding that the phenotype is not just directly, probabilistically linked to some gene. So in the old genetic medicine, you would be looking in at some gene, some marker, some polymorphism on some gene, and say, ah, this gene has a G in position 291 whenever this person has a risk for heart disease. And what you'd really be saying is, when this gene has this spelling, it's associated probabilistically with some other gene that you don't know, that is directly causing a change in the phenotype. So in genomic medicine, we want to measure this gene, but also every other gene that might be contributing to this phenotype. Because, as we well know, even if you're stuck in the same room, three individuals with the same polymorphism of the gene, they would actually have different diseases. If you look at Huntington's disease is this awful disease where you lose control of your limbs at age 40 and become demented because of an expanded number of CG repeats in the Huntington's gene. The longer that number repeats, the larger the number repeats, the more acute is the onset, the earlier is the onset. But if you take, on average, if you take a set of individuals with the same length repeat and study them, they have a wide distribution for that given length of repeat in the onset of disease. And why is that? Well, it's because they have a different genetic background, and these other genes involved in neurotransmitters, structural genes having to do with the structure of synapses and so on, are also influencing it, and that therefore this particular gene's action on the phenotype is conditional on all these other genes. And furthermore, let's not forget about the common environment and the individual environment and cultural factors which can further influence this. And I'm going to shortly point out to you that this is all too real. So in genetics, just to remind me, in genetic medicine, basically the study of what's the probability of particular phenotype happening given a particular genotype, and genomic medicine, we're trying to assess all the genes directly and capture these other factors and see how they interact. And this creates a fundamental problem. And the question you might ask yourself is, why in genomic medicine are biostatisticians not front and center as part of the process? After all, in terms of the quantitative analysis of clinical outcomes, for instance, they've been quite omnipresent. And the answer is simply this. In a traditional clinical study, like the Nurses' Health Study or the Framingham Heart Study, you'd have on the order of tens of thousands of patients and at the most hundreds of variables. And there's a lot of tried and true autoregressive models, for instance, t-tests, parametric and non-parametric tests, which work extremely well for this kind of data set. Unfortunately, in genomics, we have quite the opposite. We have 10,000s or hundreds of thousands, if you include proteomics variables, and we only have, on a good day, hundreds of patients. Especially if you're looking at something in the brain, as I explained to you at the beginning, you're only going to get a few hundred brains, let's say with brain cancer. And so let me put this in sort of grade school terms. If you have one variable, how many equations do you need to solve it? One. If you have two variables, how many equations do you need to solve it? Two. And if you have 10,000, how many do you need to solve it? A lot. If you have fewer equations than that, then it's underdetermined. In other words, there's many possible solutions to the relationships of the variables than you have available. And this is so darn underdetermined that all the traditional statistical techniques really did not work well. And therefore, frankly, the biostatistical community until recently were just not interested in this area. Whereas the computer science community, probably because they're just not really smart enough to understand how difficult the problem this was, just started applying a bunch of techniques that they had applied for other high dimensionality data sets, such as vision, face recognition, for instance, and hearing recognition, which also have a high number of features, applied these very same techniques to these data sets. And that just gives you a cultural reason why computer scientists are the bioinformaticians right now at the Center of Genomic Medicine rather than statisticians, although they're now coming into play. So let me give you a feeling for the new pharmacology. This was a study that I did with Atul Butte now 4 years ago. The National Cancer Institute has 60 cancer cell lines called the NCI-60, which they test for the efficacy of a variety of different drugs. And they have in their banks thousands of pharmaceuticals. And they have thousands of pieces of dirt, leaf, that has been collected around the world that they test, literally some leaf in the rainforest, a piece of dust in China, that they test to see how effective it is in inhibiting these 60 different tumors. And so what we did back then, in collaboration with one of my former interns, Todd Golub, we extracted the RNA from the 60 cancer cell lines and measured how much of the RNA was being expressed in these 60 cancer cell lines. And we obtained from the National Cancer Institute, for a subset of the 50,000 compounds they had tested, 5,000, let me see how I'm doing for time, 5,000 drugs that had been tested against the 50 cancer cell lines, 60 cancer cell lines, and how much they had inhibited the growth of the cells. I'll get to the details of this experiment and the computational details in another lecture. But suffice it to say, this is the overall picture. You have 60 common cell lines, 6,000 genes, 5,000 anti-cancer agents. So you have 11,000 variables with only 60 cell lines. That sounds like a miserable thing to do. And nonetheless, what we were able to do is the following. In this complicated looking diagram, we picked a correlation coefficient between all, if we computed all the possible correlations between all the 11,000 variables, that gave us on the order of 68 million different correlations. And if you pick the correlation coefficient threshold of 0.8, we found 202 networks that were joining 834 variables. In other words, only 7% out of the 11,000, and only 1,200 links out of the 68 million. 1,200 correlation coefficients out of the 68 million were above the threshold. Only one link was above the threshold between a gene and an anti-cancer agent. And let me just ask you a quick question. Why is it that we found a lot of correlations between drug effect on the cancer cell lines and another drug effect on cancer cell lines? So why did we find a lot of high drug-drug correlations? A lot of high correlations between the inhibitory effect of one drug and inhibitory effect of another drug. Why did we find a lot of correlations, high correlations? What? They were chemically similar because a lot of drugs are created are by copycat drug discovery, doing small permutations of an existing drug. So of course they have similar actions. Why were there a lot of gene-gene correlations? What? Not quite. There's more fundamental insight than that. Right, because basically, in order for the darn cell to live, genes have to have coordinated action. So not all genes, but the genes that make the ribosome, that make the transcriptional complex, that run oxidation, all have to be synthesized into RNA at approximately the same time. Otherwise, you're not going to have coordinated action. Now, there's a lot of exceptions to that, but by and large, it's true. And in fact, the whole area of expression analysis clustering, as I'll get to in another lecture, would not work if that intuition was not true. But God or evolution did not evolve genes and chemotherapeutic compounds together, so there's no particular prior reason why the inhibitory pattern of a drug and the gene expression profile should be linked. And so we were darn lucky to find even one, but we did. And it turned out that links were this gene and this drug. before I explain to you what they are, let me summarize what it means. It means that across all these 60 cancer cell lines, and these were different, very different cancer cell lines. They were liver cancer, breast cancer, skin cancer, blood cancers. 60 different cancers. The more of this gene was expressed in the cancer, the more sensitive the cancer cell line was to this chemotherapeutic agent. And it turns out that this gene is L-plastin, also known as LCP1, or lymphocyte cytosolic protein. The drug is this unpronounceable thing. I mean, a lot of these are just drugs that they obtained essentially wholesale from pharmaceutical companies. But it turns out it's a thiazolidine carboxylic acid derivative. Those of you who know anything about diabetes know that other thiazolidine carboxylic acid derivatives are known to inhibit tumor cell growth. And it, by the way, these are the same class of drugs as the oral hypoglycemic agents, the pills that type 2 diabetics will take. And a role for this gene in tumorigenicity and the generation of tumors had previously been postulated. And in fact, subsequent to our publication of this paper in PNAS, in fact, a group of at the National Cancer Institute was able to show the dose response that we had, in fact, calculated. Yes?
So, from understanding the description of the experiment and the result,
yes.
Is it safe to say, as a generalization, that whenever you find a link between a particular drug compound and a gene that presumes are genes across the 60 cell lines, that these are genes that are typically going to have a high conservation rate across the different lines?
No. In fact, if it had been true that a gene had a high concentration rate across all 60 cancer cell lines, yes.
That this drug is acting on, you know, the different cell lines is acting on this one particular gene, but there are probably differences in.
Yeah, let's just run our conversation properly for the rest of class. We don't know how it's acting. All we're observing right now is a correlation.
Okay.
Right? But I still think that you have a question in there, which is still true regardless of what I just said. So the more of this gene expressed, the cancer cell line is going to be provably more sensitive to the chemotherapeutic agent. So you had a question still.
Right. Well, it was that it didn't have to do with the concentration of the gene, but rather just that the just for argument's sake, let's say it's actually acting on the gene properly.
Okay, fine.
Okay, just because
right.
That's what, so let's say it's acting on the gene product, and across these cell lines, then is it safe? Would it be a safe assumption that the gene product would be very similar? In other words, there would be there's not, whereas with other gene products where there is no correlation between a therapeutic agent,
yeah,
you have a high variability of different types, you know, within those cells.
I may be misunderstanding your question, and I'll give you back exactly what I believe my misunderstanding is, and then, or maybe it's yours, and we'll clarify it right now. For a given gene, what we're measuring is a gene product, which is the amount of RNA being expressed. And basically, what we know is that the gene product is the same for every cancer cell line. It just, they don't have a new gene. They have the same complement of genes, but just from the point of view of this experiment, the only thing that's different between the 60 cancer cell lines, in a very reductionist point of view, just looking at the gene expression, is how much of each of those genes they're making.
No,
you're addressing a whole other layer of complexity that it may be very, very true, but we just didn't measure.
Because I thought one of the take-home messages was that for a sort of fundamental gene products,
yeah,
within a pathway,
yep,
those are where you're going to find your links to therapeutic agents more than, say, something, you know.
What we got out of this, so the answer is not in the way that you conceived it. Because if you're doing and by the way, it's a good point because it reminds us again of the distinction I drew at the beginning with that very simple dogma diagram about DNA, RNA, and protein. There would be a study where you'd be looking at the genotype and saying, doing the very same study, and not looking at all the possible genotypes and saying, which genotypes are the most predictive of this kind of expression, but here we're looking We're not worrying about individual differences in the genes. We're just looking at the amount of the gene being expressed. Nonetheless, if there was, for instance, a direct effect, in other words, if the more the gene is expressed, the more sensitive the cancer is, short of actually going and understanding the biology, which is the right answer, you can still ask yourself the question, so if I make this gene more highly expressed with a vector to make it more expressed, will the cell line become more resistant, more sensitive to chemotherapy? That becomes a therapy in and of itself. But thanks for asking the question. So just now, and this should give you an idea why in The Economist just appeared within the last 2 weeks, the following cartoon that was part of an article called Malignant Maths, where they're arguing that actually coming up with these comprehensive models, of which this is a very simple example, of susceptibility of cancers to treatment and risk to cancers, is actually become so mathematical that we can actually have a whole new class of researchers who are going to take advantage of these models to actually find new therapeutic agents. So let's go to, we've talked about how much of these data measurement techniques are available today in a large scale. To discuss the genomic versus genetic, let's now talk about heredity. So the way a population geneticist thinks about heredity in the so-called broad sense, with a capital H, is as following. Heredity includes all genetic influences on the phenotype, whether due to additive, dominant, or interactive effects. So when you hear in a technical paper heredity, what they mean is the ratio of the variance due to the genotype over the total variance of the phenotype, where the variance of the genotype is additive, dominant variance, and interactive variance between the genes. That's the technical definition of heritability. So let's think about that in a concrete fashion. Don't some people just eat and not get fat? Isn't that true? Isn't it in their genes? In other words, these poor people who just, no matter how little they eat, they're just going to balloon up. It's just tough. And, you know, it's really their problem that they have this genetic background that makes them at risk for this obesity. So we've got a real big problem. So the way to think about it is an experiment that I only dared to do 4 years ago at MIT. I asked all the Asian students in the classroom to raise their hand. They raised their hand, and I told them to leave. Very upset with me, and they walk out the room. Then, of the remaining students in the class, which, since this was MIT, it was about 30% left, I say, take your pulse, and everybody took a pulse, and I found a nerd in the room, and I said, fire up Excel, and everybody called out their pulses, and I had the nerd take the average and the standard deviation. Welcomed back the Asian students, and went through the same process with them. Everybody takes their heart rate, retaliate, mean, standard deviation. And then we show on the board, and in fact, there's a more than two standard deviation separation between the Asians and non-Asians. And I explained to them, as you well know, the basal heart rate of non-Asians is quite a bit lower than that of Asians. And they sort of look puzzled. Did I know that? Really? Really? I guess maybe. I don't know. And then I say, well, is that really right? And then suddenly it dawns them what's happened here. We're not talking about genes. What are we talking about? What?
Work.
We're talking about environment. Because basically, I pissed them off by doing a potentially racist thing. So the catecholamines were pouring through their veins. And I made them get up. And so I did two major environmental stimuli, which changed their physiology. But if you didn't know that hidden variable, you could legitimately come to the conclusion that there's some racial stratification around this phenotype, and therefore is reduction to genes. And you could ask the same thing about the overweight people. You could say, look, they're eating just as much as I am, and somehow they're getting fat and I'm not. So obesity is just a massive epidemic. And that's the point, it's an epidemic. This is the prevalence of obesity. Note, just from in the last 40 years, exponential rise. Now, I defy you to find any possible genetic evolutionary model that explains how our genome changed so fast in 30 years. And note, by the way, this is the same time as the amount of calories from fat has been steadily decreasing. In fact, there's some argue that's the cause of it, by the way, because we've substituted that, those fat calories with carbohydrate calories.
But it's U.S. only.
By the way, there's a lag. But even third world countries are now beginning. The moment they become caloric sufficient, they actually are showing this. And so obviously it's not genetic, and it's actually conditioned on some significant change in our environment, most likely having to do with our combination of our exercise patterns and our dietary composition. And yet, if you did not understand that, you'd just be hammering on the genome. And it's that kind of reductionism that we have to be, that we have to avoid. But if you think as in terms of genetic medicine, not genomic medicine, where you're really thinking comprehensively, you could easily run into this kind of error. And so how do we define environment, diet, daily habits, environmental insults, medical care? And so the genotype does not capture the individual patient state. It's what I told you before, but I think it's a graphical example of how that's true. So we need to capture and quantify the environmental influences. We need to capture the effect of the genotype and the environmental effects on the phenotype. And these two comprise history, physical, laboratory studies, imaging, which in fact, you'll all recognize, those of you getting medical training, is the basic medical history. And so if we really want to do the comprehensive kind of studies that we need to be able to dissect environmental and genetic interactions, we have to have these data items. And that's why this is part of genomic medicine. Because for those of you who are going to be doctors or clinical researchers or researchers studying clinical phenomenon, somehow you're going to have to be able to get this accurately and at large scale. And that's kind of boring, frankly, but non-trivial. And so this is just repeating what I've said, but I just really want to emphasize it. There's more to the state description than the genome. Given the necessity to capture both environment, genomic state, and interaction, it's only then that we'll be able to elucidate the variation of the environment due to the genome and to the interaction between the environment and the genome. I mean, for example, you're only going to figure out the risk effects of smoking on lung cancer if you can quantify well the environment, which is both the smoking and the exposure to other harmful chemicals in the environment. And it's required for effective new therapies, it's required for deeper understanding of a mechanism, and it requires capturing the aforementioned interactions. And the less we capture, the more underdetermined, in the sense that I gave to you, the system is. We're running out of time, and one thing I want to make true for this class is that I will always end on time. So we'll just talk about the last bullet, and at another time I'll talk to you about accelerating consumer activation. Here's a standard pediatric question. You have here the static growth curves in height and in weight. And you have a patient who's falling off their height curve and sort of falling off their weight curve. And in order to diagnose them, you have heights and weights and family history. You can take an x-ray of the wrist, you measure breast development or size of the testicles. And the disorders show characteristic patterns on a growth chart. But if you have the misfortune of sending them to my clinic, we'll also do some other tests. We'll look at thyroid function. We'll look at a protein called IGF-1 that's made in response to growth hormone. We'll look for inflammation, we'll look at your blood count, and so on. And if we still have evidence that you're really not going well, then we bring you into the hospital where we expose you to insulin and to glucagon, and that makes the kid hypoglycemic, so they pass out and feel crummy, and then they get nauseous from the glucagon. So they puke, and then they pay $2,000 for the pleasure of having been with us in the morning. And the interpretation remains controversial nonetheless, because there's a significant false positive rate and there's a significant false negative rate. And why is that? Because we're really not capturing the underlying process. And for instance, obese patients sometimes don't quite secrete enough growth hormone. If you're before puberty, sometimes if you don't have enough sex hormones at all, you might not, in fact, secrete any growth hormone, even though you're ultimately going to secrete growth hormone. And we're totally going to miss the following thing. Here at the tip of the X and Y chromosome is a gene called SHOX, short stature homeobox. And those of you who are doctors or medical students, do you know what Turner syndrome is? Do you know what Turner syndrome is?
I said what?
Close. You have the slight rice category. It's X, no Y. And they look like girls. And they're short. Web neck? Excellent. They're short. They only have an X and no Y. And I'll give you, after class, I'll give you the full Turner syndrome so I can end on time. And they're short. And why they're short? Because they only have one dose of SHOX. Now, it turns out, because they don't have 2X chromosomes, it turns out the most common chromosomal course of short stature in males, and it happens in 2.5% of idiopathic, that means without a known cause, short children, have SHOX mutations causing them to be short. And these mutants have perfectly normal growth hormone, but if you treat them with growth hormone, they'll grow to a normal size. And think of this is known in the literature, and it's just not tested. I actually tested just because of this darn class. I made sure I was fully familiar. Like I say, in my own clinic, now probably less than 25% of the doctors order this. And yet this is a fully treatable cause of short stature. And unlike the, it's not as expensive as the big insulin glucagon test that I gave you, and it's much more certain an outcome. If you have this mutation, you're definitely going to be short, and you're definitely going to respond. So this is just a bit of a teaser to show you how today, well within my reach, I can order the test today, and I do so. It's just not done. So this brings us to the other problem, which is education. If there are going to be thousands of mutations that are clinically significant, how in the heck are we going to teach them to our medical students who are already overloaded? And the answer, I think, and unless you can come up with a better solution, is one or twofold. Either create a whole bunch of experts whose only job is just look at the patient, assess how the doctor, say, do they have X, Y, or Z? Or we have to bring information technology to bear right in the process so that as you enter characteristic of patients, all the genetic possibilities start getting updated. And that's a problem because this is a decision tree for the treatment of prostate cancer based on an old proteomic test, namely prostate-specific antigen. And it's basically, you know, what you do to someone who has basically a big bump in their prostate. And the problem is, if you look at the literature, there's 7,325 articles. 7,000 articles, sorry about the color or lack of it. 7,000 articles would say, what is the right ordering of this of decisions based on this one test? So, you know, depending on different PSA levels. Now, that's just one proteomic test for one gene. What the heck are we going to do with these decision trees when we have to measure, when we will measure, as we can today, thousands of gene expression levels or protein levels? Makes up for a much more complex tree, and we'll never have enough patients, by the way, to sample all the different possibilities. But that's a fundamental challenge of genomic medicine. So this is what I was alluded to, and in just interest of time, I'm going to short circuit it, although this slide will be on the web shortly. If you only had 10 diseases, 10 hypotheses, and you had 5 binary tests, so there's not like prostate-specific antigen, it's not different levels in a continuous fashion, just say it's normal or abnormal, so 5 binary tests. The analysis requires knowing 63,000 probabilities to be able to calculate the probability of all the possible outcomes under all the different tests. And that's just very hard to imagine how we're going to be able to do that comprehensively. And in fact, the number of diseases is much larger than this. The number of tests that we can do is much larger than that. So that's a fundamental methodological challenge for new medicine. And in the same sense, I'm going to just now, this will be my last slides. There's evidence-based medicine is a big movement in medicine, which says, let's look in the literature and try to find out what's the best practice. And they've done this for a number of different disease areas. And there's literally thousands of doctors and researchers who are filling out this these databases of evidence-based medicine, the largest being the Cochrane Collaborative. But if you look at the genetic section, it's just a few highly penetrant genetic diseases. There's very little to guide, in fact, there's nothing to guide the practitioner for anything of these genomic diseases, for these very common diseases, which is where I stop the today's class, because we ran out of time. And for another time, I'll tell you about the problems about patients who are able to select tests, order tests over the web today. You can actually send your own samples to be sequenced, and a dubious interpretation or undubious interpretation is given to you, and then you show up in your doctor's office, and he doesn't know or she doesn't know what to do with it. But that'll be for another time. All right. Any administrative issues, feel free to...